नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स अपारुताते सम्मतस्स द्वारा यसोतमन्तो पुनचन्तु सम्भवन्ति. Okay, so for the Dhamma talk tonight, I'd like to talk a little bit about this one of the early Buddhist nuns called Bhadda Kundalakesa, and this is a little booklet that I've been working on. This is kind of a novelized version of her life. It's an extremely unreliable version of her life story, which I kind of made up because it's very fascinating to me in many ways. But part of it is some of Buddha's actual verses, which I'll read in a moment. But just for a bit of background, Bhadda Kundalakesa was one of the bhikkhunis, one of the elders who lived in the time of the Buddha, and she was regarded as an arahant, fully enlightened. And the earliest record we have of her is her own words, which are recorded in one of the ancient Pali scriptures called the Terigata, the verses of the elders. The verses of the elders are a collection of the poems, the verses by many of the enlightened nuns at the time of the Buddha. And so this collection dates from about 500 BC, or a little bit later, maybe 400 BC or so. And so it's one of the oldest times in history where you actually hear women's voices, and also especially spiritual women's voices, telling their stories and telling their life stories and about their realization and so on. And so, of course, for that reason, it's very very inspiring. It has lots of very interesting things in it. And some of them, you know, you see women definitely speaking from their own personal experience. One of the opening verses in the Terigata, the nun says something like, if I remember it correctly, he said, "Formerly my life was afflicted by the three crooked things, the mortar, the pestle, and my crooked husband." You see, maybe some things haven't changed all that much in 2,000 years. So, Bhadda, I'll tell you a little bit more about her life story a bit later, but she had a very dramatic life. And I became interested in it because she was one of the few nuns that we have a record that she was actually personally ordained by the Buddha himself. So most of the nuns, of course, you don't actually have a record of how they received their ordination. So many of you know that I've been involved in the women's ordination movement, so this is sort of came out of that. But here are just her verses, and these are just some of the collection of a few verses which were recorded about her. Recorded from her words. "Formerly I wandered in a single cloth with plucked hair, covered in mud, imagining flaws in the flawless and seeing no flaws in the flawed." So this verse she's referring back to her time as a before she was a Buddhist nun. She spent some time as a Jain nun, and the nuns in that tradition would wear one piece of cloth. They pluck their hair out with pincers, and they covered in mud because they had never bathed. That was their tradition. "So I came out from my day's abiding on the mountain, the Vulture's Peak. I saw the spotless enlightened one accompanied by the Bhikkhu Sangha. He then taught me the Dhamma, the six senses, the aggregates and the elements. He told me about impermanent suffering and not self. Having heard the Dhamma from him, I purified the vision of Dhamma. When I understood the true Dhamma, I asked for the going forth and full ordination. Then I humbly bowed down on my knees and in his presence bowed to him. Come Bhadda, he said to me, and that was my full ordination. When I was fully ordained, I saw a little stream of foot washing water disappear. I understood the process of rise and fall and reflected that all things were of the same nature. Right on that spot, my mind was released, totally freed through the ending of grasping. So in that final verse, she tells about her enlightenment experience, yeah? Watching the foot washing water disappear into the ground. That's how she became enlightened. Yeah. Amazing, huh? Something so little. And you know, remembered all of these years, 2,500 years, but that something so little can prompt awakening. So this is one of the things that we learn from these personal accounts of the Dhamma, is how sometimes how individual things are, how unrepeatable they are. And so of course when we study Buddhism, we learn about things like the Noble Eightfold Path and the three kinds of training and all of these. It's all very kind of systematic, and so that there are these kind of general ways of practicing which we can apply to everybody. But it, actually when they manifest in people's lives, they manifest sometimes in very, very unexpected ways. And that particular story is by no means unusual. In fact, it's quite common that these kinds of stories at the moment of awakening happens in some way that's very personal and very individual. So I wanted to talk a little bit about Buddha's life and see if we can sort of throw some light on who she was and what she did, and perhaps also how she was seen. So what we've seen there is as close as we can get to being her actual own words, yeah? Obviously translated into English, but probably pretty close to what she actually said herself. There's a few other verses, a couple of other verses there which I've omitted, but that's most of them. So that's not much, right? That's only a little. There's only a few things, yeah. Like, so there's got some of the key elements in her life, yeah. The former life as a Jaina nun, the encounter with the Buddha and taking ordination, and then the moment of enlightenment. But that's all we get. Just a few little snapshots of those moments. Yeah? But that's already quite a lot, isn't it? I mean, we're talking 2,500 years ago. Yeah. How many, you know, records of what people said from 2,500 years ago actually exist anywhere? Yeah? Very few. Yeah? There's only very few records from that time. So it's quite remarkable that anything at all is preserved. Yeah? And these days we can preserve everything, can't we? We put it on a blog or put it on Facebook or something like that, and it's kind of stays there. We can all have our say. But in those days, it was a lot of effort and a lot of work and something very special and very precious to actually have those few words be preserved. So, of course, one of the facts about Buddha's life is that she was a woman. And as we know, in just about every culture, ancient culture and indeed also modern cultures, that the voices of women tend to be ignored, tend to be marginalised. We hear a lot more of what the men have to say and very little of what women have to say. So that means that if we want to kind of redress that imbalance, we have to sort of pay special attention to what women, the ancient Buddhist women, were saying. Now, in those verses, Buddha doesn't tell us much about herself. Yeah. She's enlightened, right? She's not a narcissist, right? She's not interested in telling us all about her and her story and her details and everything like that, yeah? She's interested to try to convey the Dhamma. And of course the Dhamma that she actually conveys is very standard, yeah? What the Buddha taught her is the same things that he taught everybody else, yeah? The six senses, yeah, being aware of what's happening through all of the six senses in the present moment, the five aggregates, understanding these interconnected dynamics which constitute what we call a person, physical form, the feeling, perception, will, volition, and consciousness, five aggregates, and also the elements, yeah, the various kinds of elements, the four physical elements, immaterial elements, and so on. And understanding these through the Buddhist way of impermanence suffering and not self. So learning to let go. So these kind of teachings which Bhadara is received from the Buddha, very much what the Buddha, you know, very, very kind of standard, we find these things repeated time and time again. So we don't learn that much about Bhadara as a person. We do learn the interesting detail that she was a Jain nun before she was a Buddhist nun. So she was converted. So obviously she must have been in some sense dissatisfied with her former life as a Jain nun. We're not told why that's so. Well, it's not hard to imagine why it might be so. So sometimes it's said that the Buddha was the first one to start a nun's order in ancient India, but it's not true, as you see from that verse, that the Jain order existed before the Buddhist. And there may well have been other orders that we don't know about. Certainly it's accepted within the early texts, except quite normal, as a matter of fact, that there were various nuns' orders around before the Buddha started the Dhammasangha. Sangha. So that much is pretty much all that we know about Bhadara. Oh, the only other detail that the verse that was omitted there was that she then, the one of the verses which I didn't quote, was that she said she mentions a number of years, I think it was 20 years or 40 years or something like that, she has wandered across all of the countries of India, and she lists the countries, Champa, Magadha, Kosala, and so on, which is all the region of northern India. She wandered across all of this region, I think it was 40 years, she said, teaching and practicing the Dhamma. So that's also quite a remarkable thing, isn't it? Yeah, just to think, if you put yourself in as a woman in those days, to wander, it's literally walking so widely right across the whole of northern India, practicing and teaching, is quite a remarkable thing. Yeah? So she's obviously quite a special woman in many ways, but we don't, those few verses that we get don't really tell us why. Yeah? And so some of those details then get filled out in the later legends and commentarial stories. Now, for those of you not familiar with Buddhist literature, we have the Buddhist canon, which is the early texts, and those verses that I've just read are taken from those early texts. And then, of course, you have a long history of commentary and elaboration and so on based on those early texts. And those commentaries and elaborations have varying degrees of reliability. There's all kinds of stuff in there. There's very genuine historical memories and so on. And there's a lot of myth and fable and legend and so on, and it's all kind of mixed up in there. So these things all get kind of mashed up. So that's one of the jobs that I do and other people who are textual scholars is to try to sift through it and try to understand the different layers of meaning in the different kinds of texts. Now this particular story of Bhadra was a very popular one. It's repeated in a number of cases, and as usual it's told differently in every case and sometimes in quite contradictory ways. So the tradition didn't tell sort of one unified story about her. But the basic story goes something like this, and I'm not going to... A very highly fictionalized account, the one that I've got here. So I just reread that. I was just doing proofreading. This is the reason why I was thinking about it. I was doing proofreading, and I've got that in my mind. So I may well mix some things up. So don't take this as a reliable source at the moment, right? But the general gist of it is something like this, that Bhadra was born in the town of Rajagaha. She had wealthy parents. And when she came of age, she was around 16, she was enclosed, basically imprisoned by her father in a tower. Okay, so here you have the whole kind of Rapunzel kind of locked in the tower kind of thing, yeah? And for her own protection, yeah. And so this obviously is usually interpreted as being like a for a symbol, especially for a girl who's 16, she's on the verge of her sexual awakening, yeah? And so she's kind of locked up, and the father's trying to protect her and keep all the bad men and so on away from her. As if that has ever worked, right? And but in Buddha's case, it was quite extreme. And it's one of the interesting things about Buddha's story is that she doesn't just meet a handsome prince or something like that. What she actually sees from her tower window is a parade down the street where there's like this kind of warrior criminal who's being paraded down the street, being whipped, covered in red brick dust, and with all of the crowd of people screaming and condemning him. He's a murderer. Yeah, they call it, his name is Satuka, and the word Satuka literally means an enemy. So he's the enemy who's being lacerated and flogged on his way to execution down the main street. Buddha, of course, just has one look at him, and she's gone, right? She's 16, what do you expect? Huh? So she's completely in love with him, and won't accept anything else. She lies down on the floor and refuses to move, no matter what her parents will do. Right? They can't do anything. She says, if I don't have him, I'm going to lie. I'm going to die here, right? I'm going to lie here until I die. Yeah? So, what to do, yeah? We've got some parents here. Yeah. Has anyone had any similar experiences? No? No one's going to tell us any stories? Not yet. Take a stiff scotch and walk away. Okay. So what do you do? Yeah? I mean, she's really stubborn. Yeah? She's really going to do it. She's going to lie there until she dies. Unless they get this guy and release him and marry him to it. What do you do? Do you marry your daughter to a known killer? Or do you let her starve to death and die? Huh? See, and we think that kind of teenagers are like a 20th century invention, don't we? Yeah, we think it's kind of modern teenagers. We think, oh, traditional times children were so obedient, they'd always do what the parents wanted. No. It's true, isn't it? Yeah. If you look at these stories, these kinds of things are happening time and time again. Yeah. I mean, the very fact that she got locked up in the beginning, you know, whether or not it's a historical fact that she got locked up, I've got no idea whether any of this story is actually true. Actually, most of the details of this story are found in quite a few traditional tales, and obviously similar to various kinds of fairy tales and so on. So it's quite possible it's all just sheer invention. But still, even the fact that such a story exists tell you that, well, there must be something that it's based on. It can't be completely divorced from people's reality.
I think in the prisons now that there's often the romantic notion of the badly done by the female and fall in love and think that they can rescue and change that person.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Chopper Reed's first wife, uh-huh, fell in love with him, having seen him on TV or something like that, and wrote to him and kept him as a pen pal until decided to marry him, and they married in prison, had his first child with this woman, and Mary, I think her name was. I mean, he was renowned.
And did she succeed?
She succeeded for about a year or two. He sort of, his life with her became like a prison. Well, he says it's biography.
Yeah, because he. Well, that's very interesting because that's exactly what happened with Buddha and Satuka as well. Yeah. they managed to convince Mum and Dad. So Dad knew the local magistrate, and they managed to arrange a substitute, because Satika was going to, he's going to get chucked off the cliff. That's what they used to have. They had a place called Robber's Cliff, and where they would take criminals from Rajagaha, the town, there's a lot of cliffs, and they would take the criminals up there and they'd throw them off, and it was like considered to be a sacrifice to the local goddess. So they arranged a substitute, okay, so somebody else was thrown off. You know, they managed to find another criminal from somewhere or something like that, and then they chucked him off and told everybody that Satika had been killed. And then in the meantime, they took him along and got him married to Bhadda. And actually, for a while, it worked. Yeah? Now, you can imagine it would have been a little bit uncomfortable sitting around the dinner table of an evening in the beginning. But Satika always insisted that he was innocent and, you know, he'd been wronged and all of these kinds of things. And they lived happily for a while. It was actually about, I think it was a year that they lived, according to the story, they lived happily. And then Satika, and it's interesting, again, you mentioned that idea of the cage, because one of the things that comes up in these stories, I've read so many different variants of the stories, and I haven't read them recently, so I can't remember if this particular one is in the Bhadda story, but in quite a few of them they actually have the image of a bird in a cage, and that they're keeping a bird in the cage, and that the man reflects that, here I am trapped like a bird in the cage, and that image is actually found quite a few times. So he reflects, he's like a bird in the cage, he's got a longing, he needs to get away. So he says to Bhadda, I have to make a sacrifice. You have to dress up in your wedding dress and put. She had a beautiful, very valuable necklace, yeah, diamonds and all of these kinds of things. You have to put your necklace, your special necklace on, and your best clothes, and we'll take some food and so on to offer for the goddess. And this is something that I have to do because of my reprieve. Yeah, because I was reprieved, I have to go up and make an offering to the goddess on the anniversary. So she said, all right, so they did this, and they were going up there. They walked up to the top of the cliff. When they got to the top of the cliff, Satika fell strangely silent. And there's various accounts of the dialogue that happened between them. I'm just trying to remember. Bhadda noticed his silence. She said, "Why? What is this? What's happened?" And Satika said, "You fool! I'm here for your necklace." And she's like, I belong to you. Yeah? I'm your wife. Everything I have is yours." Yeah? But he's like, "This is my nature." Yeah? Maybe it's your nature to be a wife, but it's my nature to be a thief. Yeah? So give me the necklace and I'm going to push you off the cliff. Anyway, he's a pretty tough guy, Satika. And she's only 17. So Bhadda, one of the things that Bhadda became renowned for, right, what the Buddha praised her for, of all the nuns, that she was the foremost in what they call kipabhinya, which means the swiftness of insight. Yeah, she was renowned for being the foremost in swiftness of insight. And this is a faculty that she displayed at that point. Right? How is she going to get out of that, right? Here's this murderer, he's got hold of her, he's going to shove her off the cliff. Yeah? She says, she appeals to the one thing which you can never underestimate, and that is his male pride. She says, "You're my husband." Yeah? Many women die for their husbands. Yeah? Remember, this is India, it's nothing unusual for a woman to kill herself for a husband. But no matter what you do to me, I'm still your wife, and so let me honour you and pay respects to you like a wife should to a husband. And so she did in ancient India, you do the practice of what they call the dakina, is you to circumambulate, keeping your right side, like you do that for a stupa, or it's like bowing, like the way we bow, except it's like a step up from bowing, is you do the circumambulation. And so she did this circumambulation around her husband 3 times. Yeah? Except on the 3rd time, she was behind him, she shoved him over the cliff.
Why didn't she just give him a piece
of her? He had hold of her. He wasn't going to let her run. He was going to kill her. One of the interesting things about that story, there's several, as I said, there's several different versions of it in the ancient Buddhist scriptures, but it's also a very, very widespread folk tale and folk song motif, and found all across Central Asia and as far as Europe and so on. There's one version of it. The most modern version that I've found is one called the Ballad of May Colvin. And this is, I think, an English or Scottish folk ballad from about the 19th century. And it's quite a popular one. You can find, there's versions of it on YouTube and things like that. If you look for May Colvin, C-O-L-V-E-N. And essentially her story was that she was living at home and this stranger came to the home, wooed her, married her, took her off on a horse. He took her to the cliffs. And she had a bird as well, which is one of the kind of a nice little kind of thing in the story. But the fellow took her off to the cliffs and said that he was going to take her jewelry and her clothes and throw her off the cliffs. And she said, "Well, you can do that, and you can throw me off the cliffs, but it's not proper for a man to watch me while I'm undressing. So please turn around while I take my dress off." So he turns around and then she shoves him off the cliff again. So, amazing, huh? Yeah? So it's a very, very similar story. And as I said, there's dozens and dozens of different variants of it. Anyway, Bhadda. Now imagine, you'd be pretty messed up by that stage, wouldn't she? Yeah? She's her whole... She staked everything in her family life on this marriage, right? Her parents have done so much, everything for her, and it's just been a complete disaster. And what can she do, yeah? I mean, especially in a society like ancient India, there'd be no possibility of remarrying or having any kind of normal life after that, really. What are her options, Basically, she could, stay at home and be an old maid or become a prostitute. I mean, realistically, that's probably about the only options that she'd have. So she's, and of course the whole confusion and trauma and guilt about the whole thing. So we don't quite know how it happened and what went from that stage, but anyway, she ended up in a nunnery. Yeah? And so this is how she ended up with the Jain nuns. And again, that being quite a realistic option for what she could do at that stage. Now, one of the story itself doesn't tell us particularly about why she went to Jains and why she was practicing with them. But one of the most fundamental features of the Jain teaching is the idea that that when whatever deeds we do, good and bad deeds, we call our karma. So our karma makes karma is a cause of suffering. But karma is like, in the Jain philosophy, karma is like almost like a physical, quasi physical thing, like a kind of a subtle matter, which has to be burnt off. It's almost like a purification thing, like burning off metal, like you'd smelt metal and burn off the impurities. So there's this kind of idea that karma has to be burnt off, and the way you burn it off is by doing austerities. Yeah, what they call tapas is literally, kind of the literal word is burning, but what it means is various kinds of self-torment and self-mortification. So even though the stories don't actually make that connection explicit, but it seems to me that it's quite likely she was kind of driven by this guilt and confusion she had about this act that she did, where she killed her husband, yeah, and went to the Jain teaching because she thought through that kind of the ferocity of those ascetic practices that she could somehow burn off that past karma. And as the verses that we heard there, you know, talk about her, you know, owning one cloth and covered in mud because they wouldn't bathe and so on, and pulling the hair out, yeah, so they, instead of shaving their head, they'd pluck their hair out. These being some of the basic austerities, of course there are a lot more. So eventually she left the Jains, so it seems that there was a kind of a distancing from it. And there was a next phase in her life. We're not quite sure why she left. Again, there are different versions of that. But the next phase of her life, she was a kind of a wandering philosopher / debater. And again, this is something which is quite a normal feature of the landscape in ancient India, that people would wander around the place and debate about various philosophical and spiritual issues and so on. But of course, in most cases, it was men, obviously. There are a few cases recorded in the Buddhist scriptures of women doing this. And here we're talking about the non-Buddhist traditions. But there's a few cases, but of course mostly would be men. So it'd be quite an unusual sight. But what she would do is, she would go to a town, and there was like a little ritual that they'd do where they'd make a mound of sand, and in the mound of sand she'd plant a sal tree. Or sal tree branch. It's a little bit like putting up a Christmas tree or something like that. And again, that particular ritual is not really explained anywhere. But as far as I understand it, you know, it's a little bit like, it's like a kind of a setting up of a temporary sacred tree, like we set up a Christmas tree or like the Bodhi tree or something like that. So it's making a kind of sacred space, a little bit of a shrine there, as a sign that here we're going to be debating about spiritual matters. So she'd go from town to town, setting up her little sal tree and challenging anybody to a debate, right? So that's what she'd do, right? Roll up there saying, bingo, come on, I'm going to refute you, yeah? And then she did, and she refuted all of the other philosophers around the place until they're all too scared to come and debate with her, right? Because she was just too good, yeah? She beat everybody. Until finally, of course, the day comes when she meets Venerable Sariputta, the Buddha's great disciple. Of course, this part of the story quite conflicts with her own verses, because her own verses, it's obviously she encounters the Dhamma through meeting the Buddha himself, whereas in this commentarial story it says that she encountered the Dhamma through meeting the Buddha's disciple, Sariputta. And she thinks she's going to stump him like she stumped all of the others. But he asks her one simple question, and the question is, what is the one? What is the one thing? That's pretty much Buddha's answer as well. Yeah, she couldn't find an answer. The answer to the question in Buddhism, the answer to the question "What is the one?" is that all beings, all creatures are sustained by nutriment. Yeah, because it means that all beings, all living things, are conditioned. Yeah, that we have to live in dependence on our environment and on our context. And so the converse of that, of course, is then freedom from those conditions, is then the freedom for all living beings. So this is the one. So when she got stumped by that question, she then had to become Sariputta's disciple, so that's when she went off and became ordained. But it's kind of interesting that episode in her life, you know, why she felt the need or that drive to go around engaging with everybody and, you know, trying to refute them and trying to defeat them, yeah? So in some sense, she was still very much looking, you know, looking for the answer. And so this is one of the things that we get out of Buddha's life, is this sense of this incredible determination, yeah, that, you know, to do, you know, that, you know, even if it's misdirected, like when she was a teenager, she was using it very foolishly, but still she had incredible strength of mind. And then when she became a Jain nun, to do those austerities and so on, again, it's an incredibly difficult thing to do. Yeah, for most of us, we find it hard to sort of sit meditation for half an hour without wriggling or something like that. Yeah, but incredibly difficult thing she was able to do. And then, you know, wandering around, engaging in the debate. Maybe she had something to prove. Yeah, Maybe she had something to prove. But you can see through that process, there's a kind of a gradual spiritual evolution happening. You know, she's growing. Yeah. So, you know, from the start of the story, she's just completely passive, right? She's a child. She's not making her own decisions. Yeah. And then when she decides she wants to marry Sataka, for the first time, she's actually taking control of her life. Yeah. Even if she does it in a bad way, yeah, but she's in control. She's saying, I'm going to make this decision for my life. And, you know, remember, this is ancient India. We're talking arranged marriages and all of these kinds of things. But she says, no, I'm not going to have any of those things. I'm going to have what I want. And so there's that kind of arising of that sense of independence. And again, going forth with the Jain ascetics, again, there's a very much of a self-reliance, yeah, that she, through her own willpower, her own energy, is going to overcome. And the even though perhaps doing the austerities and so on, the Buddha said, is not particularly effective, but still, it's still within the context of a lifestyle based on not harming, yeah, on the basis of a lifestyle of keeping very good ethics and all of those kinds of things. And that kind of spiritual development is acknowledged in one of the stories. The background story says that after, you know, she was very foolish in marrying Sataka, but after she shoved him off the cliff, you remember that they were taken up there to do a sacrifice to the local goddess, yeah, so the Deva. So she, the local Devi. So after she threw him off the cliff, the Devi then said some verses in praise of Buddha and says that it's not only men who can be clever, but women can be even cleverer than men from sometimes, yeah? Because she tricked Sataka. So she's evolving, yeah? Even though in a very twisted, very conflicted way, but she's gradually evolving. And then when she goes from the Jains to become a philosopher, again, that's like another step in evolution. She's learning to use logic. Yeah? She's learning to use reason. She's learning to actually engage and on a level of kind of very abstract and difficult philosophical context and be able to participate in that intellectual culture. Again, which is like a great step of growth. And then when she encountered the Buddha, of course, then took that even beyond the mere philosophy to the experience and to the realization of liberation. So I think it's a very lovely story. It's one of the reasons why I wrote it up as a little book. But it's a lovely story because, you know, even though as I said, all those background details, yeah, many of them probably not, you know, historical, but they still capture something very meaningful to me about spiritual progress and about the path that we have to take. So that's just a little few words about the life of Buddha. And I don't know if anyone has any other questions or anything else you want to know about Buddha's life.
Does it say how she died?
No, I don't know any records how she died. The only later records that I know of were that much later, we're now talking 7th, 8th, 9th century, so more than 1,000 years after Buddha's life, they were still writing books about, and I'm just trying to remember what they were. There was both a Buddhist book and a Jaina book written about Buddha and about her debates and so on. So she was like the centerpiece of these debates between the Jains and the Buddhists in these texts, which were written more than 1,000 years after her life. So her memory was still very vibrant in the community. So even though she's not well known in Buddhist circles today, but obviously she had quite an impact.
But isn't there also thinking in terms of Lord Karma, and she, when she was younger, she killed. So how did the karma come to us? So some of the other stories, when you look at the karma dark,
Yeah, well, that's a kind of it's a kind of controversial. I mean, that point is one of the key differences between the Jaina view, which is that you have to ripen all your karmas before you can get in line, and the Buddhist view, which is about, it's not about ripening karmas, but it's about understanding and letting go. Yeah. So if she's able to understand the deed and let go of it. Of course, the killing itself is very morally ambiguous. Yeah? It's not as if it's a straightforward. I mean, she murdered him, no doubt about that. But whether she acted in self-defense, yeah, whether it's justifiable homicide, or it's a very ambiguous case. Yeah, but certainly, certainly there would have been a lot of guilt and so on there, which she would have had to deal with.
The happening karma was just awakening of the inside and comprehending of his life exactly what.
So it's much more about comprehension of it,
yeah,
rather than actually living through the results of it.
Did the Buddha ever say anything about the murder? And
no.
Pass judgment or
no, but see, that part is all part of the commentarial story. So her verses themselves don't mention anything about that, so quite possible it was wasn't actually historical event.
Can any past bad karma stop one from attaining arahanthood?
Only certain specific kinds, like usually the traditional, if you kill your mother and father and kill an arahant or something like that, these traditional ones. But apart from that, we even have the case of Angulimala, who was a serial killer. And he got enlightened, so there's hope for us. it's an amazing thing, isn't it? Yeah, that's from the Buddhist tradition. Yeah, even a serial killer, can attain enlightenment. Yeah, it's very important to remember that, because that still comes up today. For example, in consideration of things like capital punishment. Yeah, and from the Buddhist point of view, even someone to murder or whatever, they're still completely capable of redemption. And there's actual real stories of this. It's not just a fantasy, but there are real stories of people who were killers and who did have a conversion and did have a redemption in while they were in jail, and even developed very good meditation. I don't know if any of them became enlightened on it. I don't know. But there was one story a few years ago that happened with one of the monks who was my teacher, Ajahn Pasano, and he was in contact with this fellow who was on death row in America, and I can't remember all the details of the story, but he wrote a little booklet about it. And he would go to see this fellow, and he was very genuinely remorseful and all of those things, and he was practicing meditation and having very good meditation and so on. And he genuinely had overcome those things, and yet they still put him to death.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Sorry, question related. So we see, like within, say, the Vajrayana tradition, that the notion of karma is so much more complex and diversified, and something that seemingly is quite malleable. So, in the sense of there's these purification practices that one does, to purify the negative karma.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, historically, with the establishment of, I think it was Nalanda, and the emergence of how there's a fusion of influences from Tantra to Vajrayana. Is there aspects of the Jaina sort of notion coming in there? Is this a later development as opposed to
quite possibly, but I haven't actually studied that in detail. I'm not familiar with those aspects of Vajrayana teachings very much, nor have I looked at the historical context. But generally speaking, yes, it's very like. But it's not just in Vajrayana, although maybe expressed more formally that. But just generally within popular Buddhist culture, and within just Indian popular culture generally, you have these kind of notions of karma, which often kind of have become more and more. Frankly, appalling in many ways.
Because then, even within, say the Goenka system, the notion of uprooting sankharas, and he's always very explicit that he feels that there's a pure doctrine there that he's teaching. But there's an influence there from Buddha Gosa as well. Did he sort of, is that something that he talked about, or where did this idea come from?
Not, I mean, to me, the Goenka teachings always have a Jaina kind of flavour to them. I'm not aware of, as for those of you not familiar, but the Buddha Ghosa is the Theravadan commentator in about 500 AD. I'm not aware of any passages in where Buddha Ghosa talks about those kinds of things.
It's just interesting with such an idea like where it
is. Yeah. Well, tradition's always fluid. You know, so they're always fluid, there's always give and take, and yeah. No such thing as a fixed tradition. Well, there is, but only dead ones.
Could any ordinary woman mention
this? I mean, lay women?
Ordinary women. Because the nuns that you hear about have had massive, huge trauma, and the woman is real go get 'em.
Yeah.
You know, only get your gun types.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of the woman whose name escapes me, who in the same day lost her husband, lost her children,
and
lost her parents.
Yeah.
And went naked, screaming mad.
Became
somebody who wrote crisis as well.
Patachara.
Stories of. But you've got to be like really out there, and I'm quite ordinary. But I mean, is it this intense pain to go from stark raving lunatic to enlightened in one lifetime? To my mind, it's a bit of a big ask. Have you got? Is there something about this intense? Is it the intensity of the suffering? Do you need
no.
the rocket fuel?
No.
I've got to go out looking for this intense.
You just talk about those things because they're good stories. I mean, someone I went and meditated and it was pretty good, and then I got rid of my defilements and, I became enlightened. So, it's good on you, but it's not a very exciting story, yeah? So you know the ones that's true, but it's the ones who are remembered are the ones who have dramatic or fascinating stories. I'm sure many others who won't. And that's one of the things that comes through these verses. It's very individual. Yeah.
So you have this. I forget the lady's name, but he was so just about the Buddha thought him. So she got enlightened as well.
And again, that one's very, very common kind of dynamic.
But I think also, I think this happens a lot with women, is that, like, the really ambitious women, the really kind of feisty women, people don't understand that, and they sort of think, if a woman is kind of feisty and ambitious, they need to find some explanation for it, because it just doesn't make sense in the context of what is expected from a woman. So they have to make up stories sometimes, like, oh, she must have been through some trauma, she must have been abused, she must have been treated badly, and that's why she's like that, that's why she's angry and feisty. They just can't understand the idea of a woman just being like that naturally, like that's just her personality without any sort of major drama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be.
But one thing is certain, Nibbana is described as cessation of craving, letting go of attachment. So clearly, if one experiences extreme trauma and loses the most beloved, one's love, naturally, what is there left? You know, so it naturally inclines one towards letting go.
It can do if you've got some wisdom, and other people just get depressed or whatever. But yeah, certainly in those cases, that's what it did. Yeah, absolutely.
I just like the story of Deepa Ma. I think it's one of Joseph Goldstein's teachers, and she lost her family in a very short space of time. And she came to meditation practice very late, and you know, from those who had studied with her and practiced with her, widely regarded her as an arahant. You know, and in such a short space of time, they said it's just profound how quickly she progressed. But had an amazing trauma.
But usually most of us have enough trauma, don't we? After going looking at it.
Just watching the mud go down the drain sounds more appealing.
Yeah. And but it's the amazing thing about this is that, you know, there are those incredibly dramatic stories, and there are also those, you know, incredibly mundane ones that it's just, you just can't capture it. There's some moment there. There's some way that things come together that it's just something you can't repeat. That's why I'm always just a little bit suspicious of spiritual systems when they get too set out, you know, too much of a system, too much of this stage and this stage. Yeah, systems are good. They give you some guidelines and some help and some structure, but real life isn't quite like that. But the other thing is that to come back to what you said before, Nicola, about the, you know, people who are kind of going mad, and that's something with the Buddhism and psychotherapy group that I do, we've discussed sometimes, and you know, obviously it is the case that some people have, you know, various kinds of psychoses or something like that if they're practicing in the wrong way or too intensely and so on. But it's also the case that people can go through periods where, you know, they're going to look like they're mad or seem like they're mad, yeah? And actually, you know, it's part of that kind of, you know, it's a crisis or whatever, but they come through it and they're actually better out of the end of it. And when we're talking, you know, with this group of Buddhist psychologists about this, you know, all of them done intensive retreats and stuff, and just about all of them said, yeah, well, this has happened to me on you know, retreat one time or another, yeah? Mm-hmm. And, you know, you do things that certainly from the outside maybe look as if they're pretty mad, yeah? But somehow, sometimes things have to break down before they can rebuild them again. Yeah, so this is why you have to be very careful with these things, because sometimes you don't know, is this just something that's going to break down and stay broken, or is this just something which is being shaken up and which is going to settle down again in the future? There's two quite different things. Yeah.
They make for good reading.
What, their stories?
The crazy.
Yeah.
Various sort of stories of yogis who lost their mind and for temporary periods. And I was just reading one about Bhagavan Das, this Western guy from the US who went to India in the early 60s, and he said he did all these austere practices, but got into such a state of meditative bliss. He came out and he said everything was like the essence of God, you know, it was just blissed out. And he said he went outside to go to the bathroom, and he was just looking down. He's like, wow, it's like nectar of God. And he went and peed all over himself, and was like, you know, and so his yogi mate thought he had actually lost his mind and locked him in a room for a few weeks. And he said he didn't care because he was so blissed out. Like, he just thought this is amazing, you know. And he said he just woke up one day and was back to the mundane world. And it was gone. And so
then he went and had a bath.
And maybe the traumatic stories are told to give people hope. Looking up, well, okay, if that person can undergo that transformation, then there's hope for me.
Yeah, definitely.
Another thing is, I think normally we have regularized kind of thinking.
Uh-huh.
We think according to a certain pattern.
Yeah.
It could be conditioned by the way we have been living so far. And when something like a big trauma hits you, I kind of propels you into thinking in different line of manner.
Right.
Like what happened to Prince Siddhartha when he first saw the aged person and the person who was dead.
Yeah, yeah.
And then that new line of thinking might put you on path to Nibbana, because then you kind of realize this is the true nature of things.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not the way I have been feeling so far.
That's right. Yeah.
There's a new reality. And then if you are lucky and you get to hear something which is correct, like Dhamma, it can enlighten you.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, you need. There's got to be some kind. There's got to be some
unsettling.
Some unsettling. Some crisis.
Emotionally unsettling.
Yeah. Get you out of the rut. Yeah.
When it hits you, very with high impact. The chances of realizing what is true is greater.
Maybe it's why Buddha always emphasized so much life is suffering.
I've always had an issue with that. Is life really suffering, or is it the ignorant way we relate to life?
No, life's just suffering.
Life's yeah. suffering.
Just
deal with it. Yeah.
Always rely on that. I do frequently. Oh, that's a problem. No, it's not. It's empty.
But I guess when like that statement is meant to talk about like a subtle kind of suffering, like the fact that everything isn't always going to be satisfactory, and there's always just existing, you know, isn't life perfect? I mean, isn't that he wasn't talking about suffering as in you're going around, you know, feeling really burdened. Just that it, this is my interpretation anyway.
And also I tend to think of the opposite actually, eternal happiness. Okay. That's a positive way of thinking. Why do you want to be happy for the moment? Why be happy? Well, look at eternal happiness as well. So, nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Because yourself can never be totally